debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Here's my favorite rant for the day, excerpted from our podcast, which you can find over at TomHartmann.com. Welcome back. This is fascinating. Somebody on Twitter, let me get over there and attribute it to the right person, Rusty Cannon on Twitter, tweeted to me this article from businessinsider.com. Every year, this is pretty amazing. Every year on the Monday after daylight savings time in the spring. Now, the change back in the fall, we get an extra hour of sleep, and so everybody likes that. There doesn't seem to be a problem associated with that. But the one in the spring literally kills. On the Monday of daylight savings time, hospitals nationwide see a 24% increase in heart attacks. By Tuesday, that rate has dropped by 21%. So there's still another 3% increase in heart attacks. But it's like it's just losing an hour's sleep, basically. According to the article, the average American loses about 40 minutes of sleep as a consequence of this change. And the author goes on to note that it takes weeks to recover from this. We're prone to make more deadly mistakes on the roads. The researchers estimate that car crashes in the U.S. cost likely 30 extra people their lives over a 9-year period from 2002 to 2011. And also in the week of the springtime week of daylight savings time, we have more injuries at work, more strokes, and even more suicides. So this, and this article says Florida and Massachusetts are starting to lobby to ditch the switch. I think we should just do it nationally. So, and it's not really saving anything as far as we can tell. So, actually, it is daylight savings time. Okay, our performances, yeah. And another person says, too bad you don't take questions from your Twitter feed. What can be addressed before November to repair the damage by the GOP and 45 and Trump to our government? We just need to wake up as many people as possible. I mean, every one of us needs to make part of our personal mission to turn people on to progressive media, get them reading progressive websites, radio and television programming, things like that. Help wake people up. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward stuff. Stephen in Huntsville, Texas. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Hey, glad to find you. I have not seen you in decades. You're looking terrific.
Well, thank you, Steve. What's up?
My background is liberal. My grandmother was a suffragette. She was a member of the American-Soviet Friendship Committee throughout all of World War II. MacArthur and Patton, she just told them, you're wrong. The Russians are our friend.
Well, in World War II, they were our friend. They were our allies. They helped us.
Yeah, our allies to a certain point.
We couldn't have defeated Germany without the help of Russia. It just comes right down to that.
Yeah, and so she always felt vindicated. I mean, she believed through that forever, women's liberation and such. And I just share that with you because my background is much of what you're talking about, and I'm sort of loyal to some of that. My questions for you to answer later in the show, perhaps, is why do you call Reagan a neoliberal? I never heard that before. And what talking with people like you, it's dialogue, it's rational, it's argument, it's substantive. Some people, like maybe the guys coming out of Berkeley lately who want to go to violence, they don't have a substance to talk about. Mm-hmm. Okay, I watch your show and you get to that. The real thing I want to understand is this deal about tariffs, and I might agree with you. My father was a union organizer for 10 years of public employees, so I'm steeped in the union thought.
So your question, So your question is?
My question is, post-World War II, the message of economic interdependence between America and, like, say, China now or Russia, right, to where it makes no sense to go to war with a company or a country that you have so much money invested in, it was supposed to be a peace plan.
Yeah, that was the theory of the European Union. That's why they put the European Union together, because, you know, Europe had just had two insanely bloody wars, World Wars I and II, and they thought, you know, if we have a shared economic future, then, you know, we won't have another war. I don't think that the European Union experiment is going. It's working out really, really well for Germany, but you know. you talk to Greeks and or Portuguese or, you know, Irish or whatever. Well, the Irish like the EU because it gives them access to the continent. But you talk to a lot of folks in other countries, and they'll tell you that their sense of it is that basically the EU is simply Germany's way of having, you know, one World War II. The euro in particular, you know, going with that single currency. But to your question about Reagan, I define neoliberalism as the belief that markets are better than democracy, essentially, and that marketplaces should be making decisions rather than governments and people, and you know that the power that we traditionally hold on behalf of the people by government, that power should instead reside, quote, in the marketplace. And by in the marketplace, the way it always ends up being played out is by those who control the marketplace, which is the wealthiest and most powerful, the largest corporations. And you know, a neoliberal question is always, what's best for the big corporations? And, you know, doing away with tariffs was great for big corporations. It's not necessarily great for the United States. You know, all our jobs went overseas, and it's not good for our security, our national security. I mean, you know, the border crossing guards, the ICE guys down in Mexico, the border crossing guys, or the, you know, the border patrol, they're wearing uniforms manufactured in Mexico. I mean, how weird is that, right? So
why is it neoliberal as opposed to neoconservative?
Well, it's using the word liberal in the context of the British use of that word, the European use of that word. In Europe, if you say liberal, what you mean is what we mean as conservative here in the United States, or as corporatist, let's say. And this is the new iteration of 19th century European liberalism. And, we're really kind of getting in the weeds here, Stephen. I think the bottom line is that this experiment, this neoliberal experiment that, you know, we really went into in a big way, Thatcher in 78 and Reagan in 80, both the United States and Europe and the UK, has turned out to be a failure. It does, you know, the theory was that we were all rich enough that if we turned everything over to the big corporations and we encouraged transnational corporate activity, that would eliminate the possibility of another world war, number one. And frankly, I don't think that we're even close to that. In fact, I think that we're staring down the barrel potentially of a war with China specifically. They are militarizing at an insanely rapid rate, and the whole conflict around the Spratly Islands and the stuff in the South China Sea is amping up the tensions between China and Japan and South Korea, and now you've got Taiwan, you know, involved in the mix, and it's just, you know, it's and there's the Euripides, no, Thucydides. Anyhow, he's a Greek philosopher. The trap that's named after him, which was that when an emerging economy begins to surpass a long dominant economy, that those countries typically end up at war, that's a very real concern. So those are the things.
I see North Korea as a buffer for Japan for China.
Yeah,
they
do too.
Nuclear weapons on their border, but they don't get called on it. So I don't think China's really interested in denuclearizing North Korea.
If they were, they would have stopped Kim a long time ago, because without China's support, Kim ceases to exist. North Korea just can't. So North Korea, you know, China's using North Korea as a separator from South Korea. You know, the Korean Peninsula is kind of attached to that part of the continent.
And it's their pseudo-nuclear threat.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, by proxy, you know, from us. But,
yeah,
excellent point. Stephen, I need to move along, but thank you for the call. Good talking with you. Rich in Greenwood, Indiana. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. When you opened the show, you were talking about trade policy and how tariff represents these benefits. And I was suddenly made to think about modern monetary theory and the value it represents and where it comes from. Both of these things are generated by the structure that creates the market. This is government. This is government direction. So tariffs are created by Washington. The idea of MMT is with the Fed, again, government. And I was thinking about how if both of these things were practiced in the same direction, there'd be this bookended reinforcement. And there'd be this support for the means of production. In other words, that which the workers control.
Right.
And the idea that there has been this purposeful demobilizing and a divide and rule that has been perpetrated by that which we call our governance. I'm reminded of a statement from the Scott Noble tripart plutocracy. And I think it was in Solidarity Forever, which was the second of the three. There's Divide et Impera, Solidarity Forever, and then Class Warfare. Carnegie Steelworks plant manager Jay Gould said, I can always hire half the poor to kill the other half.
Right, right. Yeah, this is the issue of tariffs, of trade policy. The larger, and Rich, thank you for the call. The larger issue here is that we need to have a national conversation about developing a national industrial policy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Just, you know, slapping a tariff on steel to try to help a Republican in Pennsylvania is not going to do it, right? If we need a national comprehensive policy. Great show today. We're discovering that Trump's whole reason for putting tariffs on steel and aluminum was he thought it would help get Rick Saccone elected in Pennsylvania. Looks like Connor Lamb's going to eat his lunch. We'll see. The election's tomorrow. We talked about that at some length today and all the other things in the news, but in particular trade and tariffs. Check it out. The commercial-free podcasts are available at TomHartman.com. And, of course, there's clips of the show right here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter.